Magandang araw at maligayang bati po mga kapwa Pinoy. Welcome po sa ika-isang daan at isang yugto ng Usapang Pinoy brought to you by Georgia Asian Times. Si Jane Rowland po ito, ang inyong podcaster. Ang ating pong yugto ngayon ay ang pagbabalik ng ating mahal na senador na si Marvin Lim, the first Filipino state representative for District 98 in Georgia. Representative Lim first appeared in our podcast on February 2, 2022 at episode 11 when he talked about his hopes for the future of Filipino Americans, including their future in political life. Ngunit bago ko pa siya tawagin, narito muna ang ating mga calendar of events sa community. On October 27, the World War II Georgia Veterans in the Philippines exhibit will be held at 650 College Drive, Dalton, Georgia, 30720 at 12 p.m. On October 28, 2025 is the Cobb County Philippine American History Month proclamation at 7 p.m. at 100 Cherokee Street, Marietta, Georgia, 30090. Sa November 2 naman po is a documentary called Nurse Unseen, and this will be held at 5665 Peachtree Dunwoody Road, Atlanta, Georgia, 30342. 2 o'clock po ang reception, 3 o'clock ang screening, at meron pong question and answer ng mga 4:30. And sa November 15 naman po, ang Sarani Club Induction of Officers will be held at 5 o'clock p.m., 111 Davis Road sa Stockbridge, Georgia, 30281. Ngayon po, ako ay magbabalik upang ihandog sa inyo ang ating mahal na senador. Welcome back mga kababayan. Ngayon po, please help me welcome back to Usapang Pinoy, Marvin Lim, State Representative for District 98 in Georgia. Welcome back, Marvin.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you, Jane. Kumusta sa mga bayan?
Yes, we're excited. Thank you so much for making the time to talk to us in Usapang Pinoy. It is such an honor and a privilege to be speaking with you.
I'm very happy to be speaking with you as well.
Thank you. We are excited to hear from you. So let's go ahead and dive into our conversation.
Let's do it.
Yes, it was so great to have you on episode 11 of Usapang Pinoy in February of 2022. Will you remind our listeners quickly what inspired you to enter politics and how has your background influenced your approach to legislation?
Yes, so I got into politics because I believe in not just talking, but listening, and not just talking, but showing people. And I am an immigrant myself, and I represent a community that is about 50% immigrant right under, and it is also one that is typically underserved, and they are typically not engaging in politics or elections. And there are many reasons for that, but one overwhelming reason that I have seen and continue to see is that a lot of people are from countries where the freedom to engage in democracy isn't there. We are, Filipino, and my parents are growing up in, the Marcos regime, et cetera, and the People's Power Revolution. They saw a lot of that themselves and brought a lot of those attitudes here to America. And of course, I have constituents from all over the world, Latin America, other parts of Southeast Asia and Africa. And so from them, there's often first, a lack of familiarity, but even if there's a familiarity with elections or democracy, just some fear or mistrust. And then second of all, the people that do get involved here or in other places often get involved and don't really see changes. And it's really difficult to make large changes, even on an individual or family level, let alone on a system-wide level, like even a county or sometimes even a street. And I really wanted to lead by saying, well, the first thing we can do is at least listen to people, show their stories, amplify their voices, and then find even short-term or smaller solutions to a lot of their problems, which when I first ran, it ended up being the COVID year. And so I did a lot of helping people, for example, get unemployment insurance. And to me, those are the types of things that listening and showing people and not just talking that not only helps people in the now, but also helps facilitate people's participation in our democracy, because then you can at least show them some results.
That's right.
Essentially why I got into politics, and particularly representing a community with which I share very similar background.
That's right. Thank you so much for saying that. Let's talk about budget and resource strategy for your campaign. You secured $22 million for your district. What projects has had the biggest impact? How will you allocate the future resources?
Yeah, so that was through my nonprofit. Unfortunately, that was one of the grants that was terminated this year under the current administration. And that's been a big shame, because we were going to essentially build a community center by which we could invite other nonprofits to really do very necessary work in the community. When I talk about building trust, one of the best ways to do that is to have a consistent physical presence. And especially since COVID and with the rise of technology, many people also just feel disconnected. So that's what we were going to do, and make it a very green initiative, because that was an EPA grant. Unfortunately, that grant was terminated. That was very disappointing, in my mind, unjust. But moving forward, we are still trying to do that same work. And while that particular project isn't going forward as is, we are still out there in the community meeting people where they are on their street. And it's interesting, if I'm to answer what has perhaps made the most impact, I can talk about my initiatives at the state level, but the feedback I get the most even these days from people is the work we've done around road safety, and particularly our various speed hump campaigns. So we've worked on several neighborhoods here to get speed humps, because road safety and pedestrian and driver or vehicular fatalities is a nationwide trend to see an increase there. And we've certainly seen that here. And so I'd like to think that we've helped save some lives, because we engage people to do that. They were speed hump petitions, so you can't just ask for it. We organized in these neighborhoods, got signatures to get these speed humps put up by Gwinnett County, where I am. And again, did this in several neighborhoods. So if I were to answer from like what people talk about the most, that is the perfect example of the type of work that I like to do. And of course, that leads to policy changes as well, getting more money for those types of initiatives, whether it's road safety or housing or other things. And that also influences the policies that we or I push at the state level, or if I'm engaging the federal or local level. But I think to me, it ultimately starts with what are people actually experiencing on the ground. Again, can you find like a short-term solution or a smaller solution? Because road safety will need many more things to fully address the alarming trend of increases in these fatalities. But you can do something now, and that really involves first working with the people locally and trying to make change happen that way. And again, that's the perfect example.
That's right. That's right. And we agree about the safety portion. And I am sorry to hear that grant has been terminated. So you never got it then?
We had it for about 3 months, basically. And we were able to do some work with that. But it basically started at the end of December, and it was gone by the end of April, essentially.
Oh, wow.
And like I said, that was very disappointing. While my nonprofit continues to have other grants, and like I said, we're going to continue to do the work, it's really difficult, really impossible to just replace that amount of money. And to be clear, we'd worked very hard. We had many initiatives in housing and the environment and building community parks in the 4 years prior to that. Speaking of petitions, like we had a petition that was part of our application to the EPA showing that Republican, Democrat, people in this community wanted to see more of that. That is the preservation of community spaces, particularly against essentially bad development in my opinion. People building really expensive housing that is also somehow low quality. That's another trend that we're seeing. And we've had to fight that off. rezoning by rezoning. And one of the things that we wanted to do was just say, hey, we just don't want to fight people off. We want to have our own vision. We do have our own vision of what this community change, community needs in terms of change. And so that's why we put forth that application. Like I said, it is no longer there. That money is not replaceable, but we are still continuing forward with the work in a different form because the need didn't go away. It is still very much there. And that's also more positively, the energy is still there from the community to make that change.
Yes, yes, definitely. And I'm sure that something will come up, whether it's going to replace the whole amount, but some people will be inspired with all these projects and its impact. So I am positive it will come through. So
well, thank you, Jane. I'm positive we'll come through in some way as well.
Yes, yes, that's very true. So, what are your top three priorities this term, and how will you measure success?
Yes. So, I think for me, the most important priority is very much going to be financial, and it's not just because we happen to lose, a large sum of money in my nonprofit. The reality is we are but one of hundreds, if not thousands, probably thousands of stories in Georgia, and I know thousands throughout the state. We know that there's a lot going on in terms of federal grant cuts. As we're speaking right now, there is still a shutdown, a number of different policies related to the economy, like tariffs. And even beyond or before 2025, and I spoke about this with our EPA grant, there has been this movement to really essentially have developers propose and take over land in areas like mine and develop it into as a not affordable housing or not even luxury housing, right? But really high cost, yet still not only dense, but low quality or lower quality housing. And that has been, unfortunately, the trend, not just in the residential market, but also in commercial. As fears, I think in the state, for example, there's going to be a big debate with respect to like data centers and how we use those or don't use those in particularly rural properties. So it becomes about how we use our land and who we're allowing to develop our land. And in my opinion, so much of that are people that, again, are essentially extracting from our communities without necessarily contributing to it, and that's not just in terms of the environment. Like a lot of these developments create secondary effects and other ills in our communities. And again, this is a problem that preceded 2025, but because of essentially all of these economic policies, which in some ways can go to essentially I see it as like a wealth transfer from a lot of these nonprofits whose grants have been cut to providing tax breaks to essentially larger businesses, whether they're corporations or LLCs, et cetera. I think that's only going to exacerbate what we're seeing on the ground economically. And so that's really going to be the top priorities. What can we do as a state to fill those services that have been cut because of those federal grant cuts, while also stemming the tide of, again, everyone's complaining, Republican and Democrat, about like these institutional investors in our housing and what they're doing to our community. So stemming that tide, I see that as of the same piece.
Yes.
So that's really the top priority is going to be economic development. Mm-hmm. I think with respect to my other two priorities, in my community, I've already talked about road safety, but public safety more broadly continues to be an issue. It becomes a very controversial issue. I have, a large immigrant population, and I want to do everything that I can to protect them. For me, what I see there is saying, well, what can we do? Again, not just in terms of restoring funding for example, people who provide victim services. That was actually another one of the grant cuts for my nonprofit. But beyond even victim services, how can we really create communities that are attuned to public safety? Because again, to me, so much of this must be done on a neighborhood, even a street level. And yet, especially at the state, and I can understand this, we're often thinking, oh, here are the state level policies to address whether it's opioid overdoses or gangs. And I'm not saying that that's not necessary. There has to be some level of enforcement. But at the end of the day, whether it's those things I just mentioned or gun violence, it really, to me, has to have a very street or neighborhood level intervention, because the most important thing we can do is to facilitate very difficult conversations at that level about prevention and reduction of harm. Right. And that will require, again, especially more resources in light of the federal funding cuts. And I would say my third priority is around healthcare in general. We are seeing a lot made around, you know, vaccines, nutrition, et cetera. And I think it's really important for us to be able to have our place in Georgia and myself during the work, doing the work on what that looks like. Because at the end of the day, beyond genetics, so much of that comes down to what we put in our bodies and how we facilitate those very difficult choices people make. And I think, so that's going to be, again, especially in light of fewer resources, how do we facilitate better nutrition or healthful behaviors among people that have even fewer resources? So I would say those are my top three priorities: economics, public safety, and health.
So I think, talking about public safety, what do you think, and do you have anything about sex trafficking? Are you there?
Hello,
I'm sorry.
I think you cut out for a second. Could you repeat that?
I said, talking about the public safety, one of your priorities, do you have anything about sex trafficking, which we believe has been increasing recently in our state?
Yes, that is a very good question. Interestingly, just in the last 24 hours before this recording, I've been having a lot of those conversations. It has been increasing, and we know that the FIFA World Cup is coming here next year. And we know that with those events, and especially with the World Cup, there will absolutely be an increase in sex trafficking and human trafficking more broadly. Now, again, as I said earlier with public safety, some of that must be addressed to some level of enforcement. But on the same time, especially with something hidden like that, if you do not have communities ready and trained to spot it and to do something, so much of this is still going to be under the radar. And so there's going to be an effort, and it's based in the city of Atlanta, but working with nonprofits that also serve my area in Gwinnett and also other parts of the state, to do even more training, both within the faith community and the business community, and particularly hospitality, e.g. hotels,
right,
to do those trainings mm-hmm. so that people can actually spot sex and human trafficking.
Right.
Because again, unless people are actually reporting it, police and law enforcement are not everywhere.
Right.
And so it really has to come again from the community level. And so that's what we're going to try to do in 2026, especially with the World Cup coming.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much for doing that. It's very important. With the the economic opportunity in a diverse district, your district is 87% minorities, 50% immigrants, and 25% in poverty. How do you balance economic needs with celebrating diversity?
You know, that's also a great question. And to me, I'm all about how do we use the strength of the community to address its challenges. The interesting thing about that statistic regarding poverty is if you look at, in this district, who is in poverty, and if you're looking at adults, about 80% of the adults in that poverty statistic are working. They are working. They are just obviously underemployed or cannot essentially get a leg ahead. So it's not a question of people not working. It's a question of like the economics. To me, then, so many people often stop there and just talk about our challenges, right? And
right.
that can seem intractable. To me, it's become a question of like, okay, well, how can we then use, you know, meet people where they are and take their strengths and really amplify them and design programs to amplify those strengths? I will give two examples. One is, and again, through my nonprofit, we have worked with a Construction Ready, which provides 8 certifications in construction. We knew that in this area, there are already a lot of people working in construction, but we also knew that they weren't necessarily seeing the fruits of their labor, and they weren't necessarily getting all of these certifications, which can oftentimes lead to unsafe work environments. So we knew that if we could design this program, partnering with Construction Ready and also WorkSource Atlanta, that we could lean into the strengths of what people are already doing and arm them with additional credentials so that they can essentially make more money. The tricky part there was we knew we needed to bring that specifically to Gwinnett because of essentially transportation issues.
Right.
And so we designed a program and were able to bring Construction Ready back here to Gwinnett. The first time in 4 years, we just finished a training class of 18 people, all of whom got jobs. So I'm very proud of that. The second example that I will use to the point of using community strength to address their challenges is you talk about celebrating diversity, right?
Right.
But I've said frequently, like, diversity is not the same thing as community. Mm-hmm. And so we can trot out diversity statistics, but if we're not actually addressing their needs and challenges, that's a really empty promise. And I think for so many people, it stops at just celebrating diversity. We don't think about the potential of people. And mm-hmm. So the other initiative that I'll quickly talk about is we also work with another training organization. It's called Prescolis. They do IT or information technology training. And we essentially created the same mechanism. You know, my nonprofit is able to provide stipends in addition to the free training because we know that even if you're doing training, you know, you're losing income. And that's just the reality that people have. And so, again, we're meeting people where they are, seeing where their challenges lie and helping to address that, but also acknowledging what their potential is. And I mentioned that one specifically because IT is not one of our top strengths, right?
Right, right.
But I certainly believe that with diversity comes diversity in thought. And so we need more people who are doing like coding or information technology more broadly from these different backgrounds. We will see benefit by bringing them into the fold. So even though that's not one of our top industries, I don't want to limit people in this area because I'm just looking at, you know, diversity statistics and what they are going into and what they're not going into. I believe it's a full celebration of their present and future potential and lowering the barriers so that we can amplify their strengths and not just get stuck on diverse but challenged.
That's right. I do have an idea and a suggestion if you're open to it. The Filipinos have a lot of small business owners, as in, you know, the ones who are doing cooking from their kitchens and all that. A lot of mm-hmm. them are not really out there because they're not licensed or they don't have the seed money. So I'm thinking, what if somebody has a grant or even loan system to loan money to these business owners who want to start their business, even just to help them get their licenses or help them start their businesses, even if the loan is like no interest. That would really help a lot of these small business owners. Just a thought.
You are absolutely right. In one of my legislative accomplishments, and it's from a few years ago, is working with to get money for the UGA Small Business Development Center in Gwinnett County. And at the time, that was a fellow Filipino, Benny Santaromana, that I was working with. And we got the money to do multilingual outreach and training for small businesses.
That's great.
I also happened to sit on the board of what's called a community development financial institution. It's called ACE, or Access to Capital for Entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
And they do what you're talking about.
Right.
Which does not mean that there is not still a need. But when I'm hearing what you're saying, I'm thinking of the fact that a lot of people don't know about these resources. Mm-hmm. They don't know about these resources. We saw it during the pandemic, too. There were a lot of people that didn't know about PPP, that you could get that relief for your small business. So again, that to me emphasizes the need for that level of community outreach, connection, and engagement so that people are aware and can avail themselves of existing resources. And then the second thing I would say is personally, and I won't get into the technicalities, a lot of the resources that are out there for small businesses are for people that are either literally like they're just starting or they are at a certain level of basically revenue,
mm-hmm.
which means that financial institutions are more willing to take the risk on them.
Right.
We know that that just does not meet the reality of a lot of people, whether they're licensed or not. And even the licensing portion can be very difficult to navigate. Now, we've engaged in some local efforts here in Gwinnett and in my district to bridge that gap between you might have a home-based business or just a business that's not licensed. What is the next step for you? Because you're already doing the work.
Right.
And I would like to expand that precisely because of what you just mentioned. I think, again, it fits perfectly into this idea that, like, yes, we have small business development loans, but oftentimes they're not appropriate for the stage that Filipino business owners are or other business owners, which are more on the, not the absolute beginning stages because they're already so entrepreneurial, but it is oftentimes helping them not just have the idea and sometimes not even just actually providing, creating the goods and services, but helping them get licensed, helping them get seed money. Those are the types of places where we don't typically have, in my opinion, as many resources because that is to many financial institutions, as I said, a risk, but it's a risk, in my opinion, worth taking because we also see, especially during crisis, a lot of our communities, our Filipino communities, Latino communities, they're the ones really innovating because of the need during crises like the COVID. And so I think we should lean into that.
Right. Well, I think one of the issues is that a lot of people don't know about these resources. So
exactly.
Yeah. So I guess we can think of more informational town hall meetings or just a way to let people know about the presence of all these opportunities.
So absolutely. And I will say we are still working on the date, but a couple things that I'm working on is one, working on Jimmy Carter to do outreach
right.
specific to some of the retail businesses
yes.
there on, again, some of these basics. And that's with someone that used to be at ACE, the organization that I sit on the board on. And the second thing we're doing is working with another part of UGA, which is a UGA Gwinnett, UGA Extension Gwinnett. And hopefully we'll be doing more of that outreach on a different level, again, to people who are, especially have home-based businesses. Because you can see it right where I am, like Jimmy Carter Boulevard, et cetera. There are a lot of people that are selling goods on the streets,
yes.
And sometimes that can be challenging, right? But imagine if we can equip them with more resources so they're not just doing that to survive, but actually, you know, thriving from that, hopefully licensed. Like I said, that's already a big barrier. And really serving and fulfilling a need not only for their family's income, but also for the larger community. But
that's
again,
right.
For both of those examples, we're targeting very specific areas because, again, I cannot stress enough the importance of how do you get people to know about it. It's not just about putting a flyer out there. It's not even about putting a flyer that's translated into all these languages. It's how do we literally meet them physically where they are and engage them where they are psychologically as well. And
right.
That's a couple of things that we're working on to be able to get that information to people because, again, it goes beyond just giving people a link, right?
Right, right. They have to be educated about it and know what to do, like a step-by-step thing. And also we
exactly.
have to get them engaged. It's not just because when you give the information, you're not sure if they really have understood it. So their engagement,
exactly.
then that would be an indication that they do understand it. So with the most urgent issues in your district of street racing, house evictions, and language access, which needs the immediate attention and why?
I think public safety needs the most immediate attention. We want to keep people alive. And we are in a, and I talked about road safety, so I'll put that aside for a second. We are in a scenario where because of immigration policies by the current administration, the Trump administration, and I understand people may differ on that, but let me tell you what is going on in an area like mine. We have even fully documented people that are afraid to call police or even nonprofits for issues like domestic violence, for issues like potential opioid overdose. We know that there's a so-called Good Samaritan law. If you're overdosing, you see someone overdosing, that you can call for law enforcement to come and help save a life. People are fearful of that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually ended up representing a constituent who was fully documented, but they're an immigrant, and they were afraid to show up in traffic court because they thought that they were going to get picked up because we've seen people picked up in all of these places, right, just because of essentially this dragnet.
Right.
And so there's the immigration issue in general, and I am very proud of my immigrant community, but even if you differ with me on that, I would love people to understand the impact that it's having on public safety, where people are afraid not only to call law enforcement, but even to call the resources that are there. There are people not going to doctor's appointments or even getting groceries. The schools have seen a lower level of enrollment. I remember back in January, one of the things that we're able to do through my nonprofit is I have 11 schools in my district. We have at 4 schools, we are able to teach adult English as a second language. Mm-hmm. One of my proud initiatives of leaning into the strength of the district to address some of the challenges, i.e. the economy, language. I think we can all agree it's great. It's necessary for people to learn English, right?
Right.
And so, but we saw a over 50% drop of that starting in January, people attending these classes. And so that is having an economic impact as well, but it's a very, like, very basic, most important, immediate thing. Because your question is what is immediately important? This has had ramifications on people's public safety, and it has decreased trust and the willingness of people to reach out for help in very dire circumstances.
That is so true. That is very true. You were talking about immigration status. You were wrongly flagged as a non-citizen voter. What voting protections still need work in Georgia?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, that is one of those voter protections that is still very much necessary. We've seen more and more emphasis on voter ID. And the way I'll address that is that even if one thinks that is a good idea, so let's, for the sake of our conversation, if you're listening, move past that. How is that getting administered? I had my proof of citizenship back in 2008. I produced it 5 times that I documented to, in that case, the Gwinnett County Board of Elections. And it was still a problem. So you're asking people to jump through all of these hoops. Mm-hmm. And to emphasize the theme I've said many times, especially in 2025, we've seen further reduction in the ability to fund election administrators. So they have even less ability to process the hoops that people are jumping through. And I think we need to take a real hard look at that, at what we're asking people who want to participate in our democracy and are eligible to participate in our democracy, what level of proof we're asking them to provide. In Gwinnett, as we've seen in other places, we've also seen reduction of ballot boxes, ballot box access, in terms of drop-off boxes. And other initiatives like that, there have been fewer polling places. A lot of that can be tied to just fewer resources, financial resources cut to elected administrators, which means, again, an additional burden for people. We are not that far removed. Sometimes it feels like a lifetime. Other times it just feels like yesterday over right. what happened in 2020. And there are still people talking about whether that election was stolen or not. And again, from my district, I am able to report that people who are eligible to vote are not only being deterred from voting, but actually stopped from voting because of all of these barriers that we that are now set up that are only further exacerbated by these intentional funding cuts.
Right.
So to me, the further voter protections that we need are to reduce those barriers, because that's like the first order reform, right? The second order reform is like, okay, what can we do to get more ballots or voter information translated? We have a Public Service Election Commission coming up. For those who don't know, the PSC regulates our electricity bills and certain other utilities, right? And that's going to be, because of when it's been held, that's probably going to be lower turnout. I know a lot of people that don't know this election is happening or don't know what the PSC is. It can be very complicated.
That is so
what
true.
Can we need to provide, like with small businesses, more voter information?
That's true.
Including in the culturally and linguistically appropriate
yes.
specific, right?
That's
so
right.
I would love to see that as well. I think that's very important. But even then, to me, again, that's second order stuff, because you've got to address those barriers that have been increased overall. Those are even more immediate, and precisely because of the dire finances of so many election administration offices.
Yes. Marvin, I know that you only have about 3 minutes left. So quickly, I want to ask you the last question. What exact budget line items are you targeting for childcare, early intervention, and community health?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to see more evidence-based home visitation money come to be allocated in the state of Georgia. So there's a lot within early learning and early care, and I'm proud to say that, again, through my nonprofit, we've launched several of those initiatives. Family literacy has been very important to us. However, if I were to pick one line item, it would be the importance of these home visitations, particularly for pregnant women, perinatal women. We know that the rates of maternal mortality are higher in Georgia than in most other states. But we also know that early intervention can really make a difference in people's lives. So whether you care about the rates of criminality or gun violence or employment, so much of that can be prevented by doing early intervention. On the flip side of that is, while we put a lot of money in the state budget on pre-K, we have not put as much money on that early intervention. So that includes evidence-based home visits. That includes more resources to train and certify early behavioral health specialists, right? To address adverse childhood experiences, to address the need for keeping children safe, but also wanting to keep them with their families. Can be very complex to do that. And we simply need more resources to be able to do that. So while, again, we've spent a lot of money, rightfully so, on pre-K, I would like to see us move to early intervention. And if I were to pick one line item, evidence-based home visitation is evidence-based.
Right.
And we can do so much through that level of intervention. And last thing I'll say on that, the home visitation part, you are meeting people where they are. And if there's nothing else that I've said that hopefully sticks with people, that's something that I've emphasized throughout this episode. And that certainly
that
applies
so true. Yeah. Okay. With that said, I want to thank you for accommodating our interview despite your very, very busy schedule. So we appreciate it very much. And I wish we had more time because there's so much that you have to share to our folks.
I'm happy to come back. And I'm so appreciate the opportunity. Certainly, whenever this gets released, reminding people that we do have a public service commission election on November 4th. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you so much. And I hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Georgia Agent Bond.
All right. Ngayon po mga kababayan, bago po ako magpaalam, narito po ang katuloy ng facts about the Philippines that some of us do not know. In the middle of World War II, while basic needs of the country getting scarce, one very smart Filipina rose above the hardships and served as an inspiration in the middle of famine and crisis. She is Maria Ilagan Orosa, an expert chemist, food technologist, and inventor. She offered her capabilities with all her heart and mind for the well-being of her countrymen. Because of the war, it was almost impossible to plant tomatoes, the main ingredient for ketchup. So in 1943, Maria discovered / created the banana ketchup using mashed bananas, vinegar, and spices, and added a red food coloring to mimic the taste and appearance of the original ketchup. The result is a nutritious, affordable sauce. So, every time you put banana ketchup on your favorite fried chicken or on your hot dog, remember that this is not just a sauce. This is a memory of intelligence, patriotism, and love of a Filipina for her country. Yun lang po sa ngayon. Salamat po sa patuloy ninyong pakikinig sa Usapang Pinoy at sana po ay lagi kayong makibahagi sa ating usapan. Hanggang sa susunod pong kabanata. Maraming salamat po. Hanggang sa muli. Paalam muna sa ngayon.